Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by the radio and podcast entrepreneur Phil Riley. Starting his commercial radio career in 1980 at Birmingham's BRMB, he ultimately became programme controller. In the 90s, he launched the first ever Magic Station before joining Chrysalis, where he masterminded the launch of Heart FM in the West Midlands and London and led its transformation into a key player in the UK radio industry. He went on to form Orion Media, which acquired and rebranded 8 Midland stations, including BRMB, before selling it to Bauer Media in 2016 for £50 million, where he is now a senior independent advisor. Named as one of the most influential people in commercial radio, he is also a fellow of the Radio Academy and has sat on a number of boards, including RAJAR, the influential body in charge of measuring radio audiences in the UK. Phil, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure, Paul.
That's an incredible resume already. Are you Mr. Radio?
I'm one of the guys who is still alive who was around reasonably near the start. I think most of the people that were around at the very start, there's a few of them around, but most have passed on. Those of us who came in the first few years after, the first 10 years, there's a few of us still hanging in there. So I'm one of those guys, really.
I mean, I'm an entrepreneur like you, so the figure that sticks out from the intro that I read there was 50 million. So you started as a commercial radio trainee and now you're a squillionaire.
Well, I can't confirm or deny that number. And I can't confirm or deny how much of that number I got. But I did okay. It was a good deal for me and all the other investors. And it was a very interesting experience for me because I'd worked my way up through a series of corporate roles. Although the Chrysalis thing was very much very entrepreneurial. I literally was hired as the person to go and set up a radio station from scratch. But that was within an organisation. So the Orion thing was interesting because it was me going and getting some private equity backers to give me some money to go and buy a business and try and turn it round and build its value. And we did that. The backers were happy. I was happy. The other shareholders were happy. It was a very good experience. And what was pleasing in a way was to be able to go back and end up owning the radio station I first started on. That was fun. Although the people who I knew from my early days really disliked the fact that I then went and changed the name of the radio station. So that didn't go down too well. But these things happen in life and stations get rebranded all the time. So, yeah, great times.
Let's go through it in chronological order then. You were born at an early age.
I was.
What happened next?
I was a typical school kid, mum and dad working class up in Manchester. Didn't really know what I wanted to do until I was about 14 or 15. And I was really interested in music, as a lot of kids were, but I was really interested. I mean, I was definitely in the top sort of 5 or 10% of people who were passionate about music. I was also very interested in technical things. Now, this is the 1970s, so there weren't that many technical things to be interested in, but tape machines, cassette players, record players, plugging them into each other, messing about with sound, I was sort of interested in that. And then the third thing I discovered when I was about 15 was I really liked getting up on stage in the school dramas, and I ended up as the narrator of one drama and something else in something else.
You had the show-off gene.
Yeah, I did, absolutely. And those three things sort of came together for me, and I said, well, those three things I like, what business career, what could I find that combine music, technical gadgetry and gizmos and showing off in one go? And radio just sort of popped out of that. You know, and radio is, of course, television for ugly people, and I wasn't that good looking. So all those things combined.
You're a handsome fellow.
Thank you very much.
But also, you're a squillionaire. So later on, after this podcast recording is finished, I'm going to ask you to spot me 50 quid till next
yeah,
Wednesday.
Sure. So I decided that those things really made me want to investigate radio. And I was lucky enough to go to university. And I remember my UCAS form. I think it's UCA now, or UCAS, whatever it's called. You were only allowed to pick 5 universities, and all 5 that I picked had a radio station there, because that was the only reason I was going to university. Was I thought it'll give me 3 years to play at being on the radio without having to do anything else.
And did you want to be airside at that point?
Yeah, I went and I was on air from the get-go. Yeah, I went to Loughborough, University Radio Loughborough, which was great at the time. And I was pretty much doing a show within 2 or 3 weeks, mainly because they're desperate. University radio stations are desperate for people to come on and fill up their airtime because they've got 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Anybody that turns up that, you know, hasn't got a terrible speech impediment will get a gig. So I got a gig and I learnt my craft there, doing lots and lots of shifts. And I ended up as the programme controller and then the station manager. And then when I finished my degree, I was absolutely the luckiest person because I ended up getting a graduate trainee job at BRNB. And this was at the point in 1980 when those early stations, the Capitals, BRNBs, the Piccadillys,
dominant,
the big ones, they were just making big profits. And there was a rule inside the radio industry that the then IBA had imposed, which said, if you make more than so much profit, we'll either tax you on it, we'll charge a secondary rental on it, or you have to spend it on doing good things. Capital had the Wren Orchestra. BRNB sponsored the CBSO. Other companies did other things. But one of the things that BRNB did was to say, we will train up 4 graduates a year as broadcasters. And so we'll create this graduate training scheme. And that's one of the things we'll spend our money on instead of giving it to the Treasury as a secondary rental. And I was very lucky to be one of those 4 people that year to get picked to be a graduate trainee. So I went to BRNB and I spent that first year getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to write the travel news, being the guy running round, putting the banners up at outside broadcasts, reclaiming bits of old tape to make sure they could be used again. All of the grunt work that goes on or that did go on behind the scenes at radio stations.
Is it cleaning carts as
yeah,
it was known then?
Yeah, all of that stuff. But at the same time, learning the trade.
I bet that was a hell of a year, but you loved it.
Fantastic. And mixing with the people who were really doing the show. I did a couple of overnight shifts towards the end, and then I got a really lucky break. Roger Day, who will be known to many older radio listeners, a very well-regarded presenter, was doing the drive time show on the station. And one day, he'd had to go to the dentist for a dental appointment and had told the programme director. And the programme director had forgotten to get a replacement for him. And Roger was on at 4 o'clock. And at about 4:45, Katie, who was the programme director's secretary, went into Bob's office, the programme director, and said, Bob, who's covering for Roger today because he's away with this dental appointment? Bob went, effing hell, oh my God, and literally sort of stormed out of the office. And I was the first person he met.
Wow.
And he said, Phil, you know how to drive the desk, don't you? And I said, yeah. He said, you're on. Get up there.
Wow.
And I just did the drive time. And to do the drive time show.
With zero prep?
With zero prep on a major radio station in a major town, 21 years old. I'd done maybe 2 overnight shows when no one was listening. My God, that was nerve-wracking. But I managed to get through it. And most people said I was okay. And I didn't make a complete horlicks of it. And at the end of that, the programme director, a couple of weeks later, said, actually, we think we want to give you a regular show. So I ended up being on air, and I did 2 years of daytimes. I did lunchtimes and mid-afternoons.
Was it kind of music mixed, local traffic, travel?
It was the sort of thing that you now hear on Radio 2, which is a bit of presentation, a competition, a bit more presentation, an interview, a bit more presentation, something else. The typical mixed bag of music and entertainment that you used to get all the time on commercial radio. You don't now because the industry's moved on.
And the team pioneered the art of the phone-in, did they not?
BRNB was one of the very first stations that did phone-ins, and in particular on sport. And there was a guy called Tony Butler who did the sports phone-in, and that was legendary. And Ed Doolin, who was another legendary broadcaster, did a politics phone-in. So it was really a great time to be in radio because you had to learn to do everything. And I was learning to be an interviewer, to do contests, to present music, to do phone-ins. All of that stuff formed part of my on-air and off-air education as a broadcaster. And I was there for 6 years, and it was a great 6 years, a fantastic time.
If you can give me any tips about interviewing, I'd be very grateful indeed.
You're doing okay so far.
Oh, thank you very much. But I read when I was doing some research for this that you said ultimately that you were too sane to become a long-term DJ.
Yeah, that has haunted me to a degree from all the very talented presenters that I've employed over the many years who all said, are you implying that we're mad? And of course, yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. You meet the best radio presenters. There's something about them that is slightly, and I genuinely don't mean this in a nasty way.
Slightly odd.
Slightly off centre. They look at the world in a different way. They think about the world in a different way. They interact with people in a different way. There just is something about them that's not as other people. And that makes them brilliant radio presenters. Normal, sane people, by and large, don't make the sort of charismatic radio presenters that people want to listen to. So it's something about that charisma. It's something about that desire to be sitting in front of a microphone for hours on end that makes for a magical radio presenter. And those things then tend in real life to make them just slightly not as other people. But I love them all. I've employed some of the most talented radio presenters in the UK over the years on my radio stations. By and large, they're absolutely lovely people, but they mostly have got a screw loose. So I make no bones about saying that.
We've had some quite big broadcast names on this podcast, and they are, it's not that they're false or that it's a persona, but they're different
they
after
different.
The recording stops.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing. They know how to perform in front of a microphone. They understand the way that you need to interact with the mic, the way to lean in or move back, the way to talk to people through the microphone to the listener to get the listener on their side. It's a very, very special skill. It's not something that many people have. And you, when you hear a really talented broadcaster execute those particular skills well, it's a real pleasure to hear. The best exponent, I think, at the moment I would pick out is somebody that I used to employ for quite a long time, who's Nick Ferrari on LBC.
Yeah.
Nick's got the most brilliant way of either not saying anything so that his interviewee hangs him or herself by their own words,
because they have to fill the dead air.
Yeah, or gently encouraging them. Or when they've got a caller on, when Nick's got a caller on and the caller is obviously barking mad, Nick's got a great way of just egging them on in a way that we're all in on the joke. We can all hear Nick having fun with this caller. And that's a great skill, and that requires a degree of being able to see the bigger picture, to hear the bigger sound, and to understand how you're trying to communicate what you're saying, what other people are saying, and get the listener involved and the listener enjoying that experience. And those broadcasters that can do that, and we have many of them in the UK, but those that can do that are really great, great, talented people. But they all have a screw loose.
I love Ken Bruce's Popmaster when people ring in, because it's warm and upbeat and chatty in a good way.
Yeah.
At the moment, me personally, I'm a bit off LBC insofar as, yeah, I understand James O'Brien's cleverer than the numpties that are ringing in and he destroys them, but it's been done. Do you know what I mean?
I think I was talking to somebody just the other day about radio broadcasting versus podcasting, which is where I'm increasingly focused. And one of the interesting things is that on a radio station, you've got a lot of furniture that you've got to deal with. The news, the travel, the ad breaks, people coming in, whatever. So your ability to interact with listeners is constrained because you're trying to squeeze it into very small segments. And that means you're trying to get the big hit every time. And that can sometimes come across then as being a bit overly aggressive, if you like, in terms of trying to make a point every time a caller comes on. Interestingly, I think in podcasting, it tends to give you a bit more space. You can be a bit more flexible. There's nowhere near the same amount of furniture in the show, if you like. So you can
just me and you chatting.
Yeah, you can chat for longer, and you could take something off in a different direction. So that, I think, that's one of the reasons why, personally for me, podcasting is a more interesting way of consuming audio than radio, because feel as though I'm getting more out of it. But having said that, you know, LBC and Five Live would still be my two go-to places if I need to find out what's happening in the world right now. I'll go. I mean, interestingly, Christopher Hope, who I know was a recent guest on yours, he does a great podcast, Shoppers Brexit Podcast.
Big listener. I love Chris.
Yeah, and he had a podcast which was, and it was trailed as, hey, listen to Chris's podcast as the news about the Boris deal came through. And I thought, okay, it's an unusual way of trailing a podcast, because you think, well, actually, that's what broadcasters do. Broadcasters are live nearly all the time, apart from Radio 4, but 5, LBC and on Sky, they're live. So that thing happened in real time, and real live broadcasters were reacting to it. So I wouldn't sell a podcast as, hey, come and listen to something that happened 3 hours ago, but it happened when we were recording the podcast, so it's really exciting. To me, that's not what podcasting is about.
It's about evergreen content. People are interested in you and your journey, and it needs to be as relevant a year from now.
Absolutely. And I think, so making a big deal about something happening live on a podcast is a bit odd to me. The podcast business is about yeah, something that will pass the test of time. Could you listen to it in 6 months, 9 months, 12 months and still get something out of it? Sure. Sometimes there are podcasts where the content will decay over time because things will have replaced what you've been talking about. If you're doing a political podcast every week, naturally over time it will lose some of its salience. But, you know, for others, I think it's really interesting that they can, you know, last for a long time. I was listening to some of your old stuff and I couldn't tell you if it was recorded last week or last year because it's about somebody and their journey and what they think about the world. And that still is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that's deliberate. We had Fraser Nelson, the editor of The Spectator, on recently, and I said to him at the beginning that I wasn't going to ask him a single thing about Brexit because actually, even though that was recorded sort of 5 weeks ago, it would have been out of date within 3 days.
Yeah.
And people are interested in his job and his journey as editor of The Spectator, not necessarily about his views about the Brexit situation 7.5 weeks ago, because who cares about that? I don't even know what the situation was.
And interestingly, I mean, you mentioned James, and both Nick and James were... We started with LBC. We bought it at Chrysalis in 2002.
I should say, obviously, Chris is a friend of mine and a client and a former guest on the podcast,
absolutely.
Indeed.
So when I was running Chrysalis Radio for Chris, we bought LBC in 2002. So so the original breakfast show was Jane Moore, and then the male co-host was a former ITN newsreader, John Nicholson, now the Scottish MSP. And they were the original hosts at breakfast. And then Jane got pregnant. And so we had to disband that show and sort of think again. It was only about 6 or 9 months in. Think again about what we wanted to do on the schedule. And at the time, Nick was doing mid-mornings. And we moved Nick to breakfast. This was 2003. And the chap I had at the time, who was MD of the station, said, I found this guy, James O'Brien, to do mid-mornings. And so from 2003, those two guys, Nick and James, are still there 16 years later.
And you put them there.
Yeah, which is an amazing thing to have that longevity in those two slots for those two guys, who, of course, are poles apart ideologically and poles apart in terms of how they react. For them, Chalk and Cheese to be the two principal players on that radio station for such a long time is amazing.
Now, credit to James Rayer, actually, for really making LBC work.
Absolutely. Now, the issue I think that James has got more than Nick is... If Brexit gets done, does James have to reinvent himself? Because he's created this fantastic persona as the guy that takes apart the Brexiteers and points up their shortcomings. And that's a particular view. That's great. But he's made that his own. But once we're through that particular political hurdle and we're onto something else, will James need to reinvent himself? That will be an interesting thing for him to think about, and it'll be an interesting thing for those of us who are in the business to watch how that develops, because he's a very, very talented broadcaster and he's made a great name for himself in doing a particular thing. That thing's going to change. He's going to have to figure out some new way in reinventing himself, I would think.
And interestingly, we should explain to our listeners that this will be in the hopper for about 4 or 5 weeks before it comes out.
Yeah.
So we may well have Brexited by the time it came out. But frankly,
we
might not have done.
Shall we have a tenner on it? Yeah.
Oh, well. What was the journey in terms of how you eventually started to move from being airside to, producer, station controller, and now squillionaire radio guy?
Well, the two things, really. One is, I think, a process of self-evaluation. I think, one of the things that you would always say to anybody is, you know, how you're going to develop your career is to know yourself. And we were joking earlier about presenters having a screw loose, and I don't mean that really, but the general drift. I realised I wasn't talented enough to be an on-air presenter at the very top level. I was okay to be an okay presenter on a decent-sized radio station, but I wasn't good enough to do the breakfast show, and I wasn't good enough to be on a network, national broadcast. I just knew I didn't have that degree of skill.
It's a skill, is it, that you can learn? No, it's not something that's innate.
I think it's a combination of being innate and a learned skill. But there's something innate, I think, about the most talented.
I mean, because Steve Wright, for example, the formula of his show has been there for decades. I still love the show.
Steve would be one of the few people where you might say he's developed a skill over time and it's got him a long, long way. Most people, I think you would say there's some innate quality there that you either you have it or you don't. And I just felt I didn't quite have enough to be at the very top of my game on air.
I mean, did you kind of suddenly come to that conclusion? I'm not good enough, so therefore I'm now going to be. I'm now going to own the station.
Yeah. No. So what happened was 3 years in, I was offered the opportunity to become the station's talks producer. And I thought that for me was more intellectually challenging and more satisfying than constantly being on air. I was still on air. A, the talks producer did a lot of the talk stuff. And B, it was a radio station where you had slots 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So even people that weren't doing a regular daytime shift probably had one or two weekend shows.
So a talks producer is non-music, is that right?
Yeah, and in the early 80s, any big radio station had lots of speech on as well as music because
Incredible.
The rules said you can't just be a music jukebox.
You've unthinkable got
to
have, now.
Unthinkable now. But at the time, you had to, so I was producing features every week. It could be theatre reviews, film reviews.
Unthinkable now.
Yeah, yeah. Interviews with people where I'd find a book that somebody had written and I'd say, look, instead of giving you a 45-minute interview, I'm going to do 15 two-and-a-half-minute interviews, and we're going to run them every Monday at 9:30 in the morning. It's going to be episode one of me talking to some gardener about how
unthinkable
to make...
Unthinkable now. I'm actually going to keep saying unthinkable
yeah.
now.
Yeah, it was. But at the time, it was perfectly normal. And so that's what I would do. And, I mean, the highlight of that was I had some good friends now, and they were members of the team that came into the radio station. They were both psychologists and they would come in and do a phone-in every week with one of the other presenters. And I got friendly with them and she got pregnant. And I was desperate for material. You had to fill 15 talk slots every week. So I was always desperate for material. And I remember saying to her, can we do a weekly thing about what it's like to be pregnant and following you through your pregnancy? And she said, yeah, let's do that. And so every week we do something about some facet of her and her pregnancy. And it ended up with me at the Birmingham Women's Hospital on the day that she was giving birth, doing a live piece into the Les Ross Breakfast Show. You know, it's 10 to 8. They're in the birthing chamber now, but I can't hear anything through the door. And eventually...
So you weren't in the chamber, thank goodness.
I wasn't actually in, wow. But I was outside with my ear pressed against the door and I reported on the whole thing live. And we eventually put the whole series, all of these episodes, we made a montage of it and entered it for one of the most prestigious prizes in the world, the Japan Prize for Educational Broadcasting, and we won. So that was fantastic. So I felt more comfortable as a producer. But the pay was lousy and I was ambitious for myself and I was ambitious to do well financially as well as in my career. And
my dad always says, if you're going to be miserable and cry yourself to sleep every night, you might as well do it for £1 million quid a year rather than 50 grand a year.
Yeah. And I had a friend a Brummy friend who'd left his job and had gone to London Business School to get an MBA. And I remember meeting him for lunch one day and him telling me how much money he was earning and me thinking, I'm doing the wrong thing, I'm in the wrong job.
Because you went to New York for your MBA.
I did. I was very lucky. It was a long story, but I ended up at Columbia Business School, which is one of the best business schools in the world, one of the top 10 business schools in the world. And I got an MBA there. And, of course, being a typical sucker for radio, I went to New York and ended up doing all my projects on radio stations and things to do with radio because New York was so vibrant and fantastic in terms of radio compared to the UK. And I remember thinking at the end of my MBA, well, I could go down to Wall Street and get myself a job as a Master of the Universe or whatever, but I don't want to do that. I'm really inspired by radio again, having lived in New York. And this was at the time Howard Stern was just starting on the radio there. Don Imus was on the air. Scott Shannon was on WPLJ. Anybody that's into radio will recognise these names. But this was a fantastic time, the mid-80s in New York radio. And so I got hugely excited again. And it was just at the time that UK radio was starting to become freer and we were going to see more expansion. And people were talking, well, we had sponsorship was just coming in. There were the plans to split AM and FM services. There was talk of new FM licenses in market. So all of that meant I thought, I've got to get back to the UK. I've got to see if I can find my way into the radio business. But, you know, in a management sense, doing something, you know, getting paid more money. So I ended up back in the UK and I ran my own business for 6 months, which didn't quite work. And then the then MD of BR&B enticed me back and said, look, we're about to launch a new AM service. We want somebody to run it. We'd like you to do that. And I'd been offered a job in a management consulting firm in the media practice. But this was way more exciting. So I did that and I launched Extra AM, which is a great radio station. And then I was headhunted to go to Leeds to be the managing director of Radio Air, which I was there for 4 years. And that was a real learning experience because
you were running the station.
Yeah, but not only that, this was, so for people who are old enough to remember, 1990 and 1991 were, that was a major recession,
yeah.
A really major recession at the beginning of the 90s.
I lived in York in the early 90s and I can remember there was Minster FM, but you could get Radio Air on the west side of the city, and you could get TFM on the north, but only it used to come in and out.
But Radio Air, which was known at the time before I got there as Troubled Radio Air, that was his nickname. We had 2 years, the first 2 years, where revenue dropped by 15% in the first year, and then it dropped by another 15% in the second year, and it was really, really a massive struggle to keep this station on the air. It was part of a larger group, but it was still a real challenge, and I learnt a great deal, I think, about managing under pressure and cutting costs and being innovative when you haven't got enough money to really be innovative and all of those things. And we launched a new station at the same time, and that was when we launched Magic. So I'd launched this AM service Extra in Birmingham, and then I went a year later to Leeds and launched the original Magic. And then by 1994, I got headhunted to go back down to Birmingham by Chrysalis to launch what eventually became Heart and the Heart Network.
Wow, I mean, some of the brands that you've launched have been incredible. When you launched Magic, did you come up with the more of the songs you love? Because I can hear the jingles now.
I'm actually a closet Magic listener between me and you. Yeah, I'm desperate to think what the original strapline was for Magic. But of course, what happened was that Magic just sat there on AM for a long time.
But was the proposition for Magic essentially what it is now?
It was, when we launched it in Leeds, it was more of an oldies classic hit station. So not quite as soft as it is now. I mean, what happened was that EMAP, as it was at the time, bought Melody in London and said, well, we've got this great brand Magic. We're just going to port that on because that's a much nicer name than Melody. But we probably got to stick to what Melody was doing. Melody was very soft. It was a very easy listening station. And so the idea that EMAP had was, well, we'll put the Magic brand on it, but we'll make it younger and slightly more contemporary. But it's always been a softer, you know, more easy listening than the original oldest Magic was. But it was a great brand. Magic's a great radio station name. And it was, you know, great time to be doing it. So
what came next?
Well, Heart was the big thing for me. Moving to Chrysalis, launching Heart, launching the Heart in London, and then being part of a team that bought bundles of radio stations, rebranded a whole bunch of KISS stations as Galaxy in the north, and building Galaxy into a big network, building Chrysalis Radio into, at the time we sold it, it was the fourth largest radio group in the UK. We made your friend Chris Wright a lot of money when we sold it.
I'm sure he spent a lot of that money with me.
Well,
frankly.
Maybe, yeah. We sold that business for an awful lot. I think one of my friends who was the finance director said we probably invested 70 million in buying and building radio stations, and we sold it for 170. So we made about £100 million profit for the shareholders in.
I might see if Chris will pay me more money after this podcast recording. I might just ring him up.
Can I get ahead of you in the queue?
I suspect he'll say no. So again, I'm a closet admirer of Chris.
So that was probably, I think, the peak time for radio in my career was from the mid-90s to the late 2000s. I think radio had its biggest boom during that period, and I was just very lucky to be in the right place at the right time, in the right company, with the right team, to really take advantage of that and grow the business that we had and make it successful.
I mean, it must have ticked several of your boxes in terms of, you know, you're in an industry that you're passionate about. Yeah. You can leverage it to launch these exciting brands and create these exciting propositions. And you're also commercially successful and you're sharing in that.
Yeah.
You're doing all this and, yeah, you're making lots of people money, but you're also making yourself some decent scratch as well.
I was fortunate enough to get a few decent bonuses and have some shares in the company. And,
well, you're a grafter. You earned it, if you don't mind me pointing that out retrospectively years later.
Yeah, and I think the I suppose the other thing that I would say is I think the culmination, if you trace my career and lots of people who are similar to me, I think the culmination was that I ended up being the boss. And I don't say this in a... I don't think it's an arrogant thing to say, but I think my overriding skill set in life is being a boss. I know that sounds... I just mean I think I'm better at being a boss than I would be at being a finance director. I think I'm better at being a boss than I would be at being a sales director.
Some people are better at being editors than journalists and doing the writing.
Yeah. I think the particular set of skills that I've got allowed me to be very good at that particular job, which is the person sitting in the centre, trying to set the strategic direction, trying to get people to buy into that, trying to push the business in a certain direction and trying to make sure that everybody behind was sort of following in the same direction and getting the whole business moving forward. And that just, I think, suited my particular skill sets and the stuff that I'd learnt at Columbia and the stuff that I'd learnt going through the ranks. Because, you know, most people who get to be chief execs of businesses will have been some sort of functional director, then they'll have been some sort of managing director of a business unit inside a bigger company, and then they'll become a number two, a vice president or a COO, and then they'll become the chief exec. So there's a path there, and the people that are good at those jobs will end up at the very top because they've got the right skill set. And I think that's where my skill set sits, really.
So, I mean, you built all that up, and was it after 13 years that you sold it all to Global? That must have been quite tough to move on from.
It was, but the rationale for selling was quite straightforward, which was we had tried a couple of times and failed to merge our business with the GMG radio businesses. And there were other corporate transactions that happened that we tried to be part of and didn't end up succeeding being part of, and it became clear that the GCAP business and the EMAP business were just bigger than us and we were never going to be able to catch them. And I said to the board at the beginning of 2007, you know, there's an old adage, but it's very true, it's a sort of Harvard Business School edict, you're either number one, or it's Jack Welch really, you're either number one or number two in the market or you're toast. And we're not number one or number two, and we really can't get there. The structure of the business, Chris's shareholding, the fact that we were leveraged to do other stuff in other bits of the business meant we didn't have the financial firepower to go and buy out an EMAP radio or buy out somebody else. And I said to the board, actually, there's a consolidation going on, and you either eat or get eaten. We should get eaten first because we'll get the highest amount of money. And the board agreed, and we put the business up for sale and sold it. And, you know, it was the right thing to do at the time. And I have to say Global and the guys at Global have done a great job with those assets. They've really worked, LBC and Heart in particular, are now two giant radio assets. And when I compare where they are today with where they were when I sold that business, Ashley and the rest of the guys have really taken them on and done a fantastic job.
And then after that, you're back in Brum with Orion Media. Did you recognise that BRMB was losing its audience and needed to reinvent itself as a brand?
Yeah, the challenge there was that we bought these, essentially, the heritage local stations in Birmingham and Coventry and Wolverhampton and Worcester. And the new, bigger regional players had then become Heart, Smooth, Capital. And they were all being marketed very heavily on TV, and they were eating into the audience share of these heritage local stations. And we spent a year or two trying to make the heritage local stations work as individual brands, you know, Mercia in Coventry and Beacon in Wolverhampton and BRMB in Birmingham and Wyvern in Worcester. And then we just came to the conclusion that actually it was just, we just couldn't compete in the marketing place with those guys, the Hearts, the Smooths, the Capitals, because they could go on TV, they could market to the whole of the West Midlands region, a single brand, and really take a proposition to the audience. We couldn't do that because if we just promoted BRMB, we'd be wasting half of our money. And not only would we be wasting half of our money, those people that worked for Mercia or Beacon or Wyvern would be saying, why are you spending money on BRMB and not spending money on us? So it was an impossible situation to market properly. If you wanted to, you know, TV is the only way really, an outdoor, but TV principally is the only way to really market a radio brand. So we ended up saying there's only one way out of this, and that's to change the brands and fight global at their own game. You know, they'd rebranded all of these radio stations into Hearts and Smooths and what have you. So we've got to do the same thing. And so we rebranded all of those four stations as Free, and had a pretty good go at building a new brand in that market. And that worked pretty well. And that, alongside GEM, which is the station we had in the East Midlands, were the basis for a quite successful transaction in 2016 when we sold the business to Bauer.
Bauer. I mean, they snapped up reportedly for 50 million.
Well, reportedly.
As I say, I would like to borrow that 50 quid. Do you think there is room now, though, for small independent commercial radio operators anymore? Or is that even a ridiculous question to ask?
Localness hasn't gone away. And even the stations that are part of bigger networks carry some localness and some commitment to local news. Can small local stations survive? I think they can in the right markets with the right approach. But that doesn't mean to say that all local stations can survive. But I think we are moving in the direction of a different media landscape. And radio, I think, needs to recognise that it's moving in that direction. And as radio moves more to an online or a digital world, and we're seeing 50-55% of all listening is now digital, that almost inevitably means more national brands, more bigger players, less space for local FM. So I think that there is still a market for them, but that market is becoming constrained and smaller over time. And that, I think there are some inevitable sadnesses about that. We talked, didn't we, you know, ages ago about me being on this huge radio station in Birmingham that was so big and so powerful and so profitable that I could afford to have a 3-minute gardening feature at 9:30 on a Monday morning. You couldn't do that now. Those radio stations don't really exist in the same way or shape now. Even the big Bauer City FM stations are being networked more and more. So there is an inevitable shift that way.
I mean, does it matter? And because, you know, those truly local shows, as you mentioned there, they're obviously being replaced, even on the local stations, by network programmes for the big commercial brands. And also, you know, is the music selection changing? It seems to me that it's becoming a bit more conservative now, just to kind of keep the listeners.
Well, there are more stations out there, and what you're seeing are more brand extensions. So Kiss has got brand extensions, Magic's got brand extensions, Smooth, Capital, Heart.
I see that in my car when I'm on the DAB spectrum. There's about 10 Magics now.
And that's the Procter & Gamble approach to life, which is we've got so much shelf space for our Kitty Cat product. If we bring out a new Kitty Cat liver and onion, it will grab a bit more shelf space and move somebody else further down the dial. So we want more of that shelf space. And that's the approach that the radio stations are taking by adding new brands. There's not a lot of cost apart from the transmission cost. But if they can bring some more audience in, that means more audience for them to sell as opposed to their competitor. So, I mean, that's a perfectly logical business thing to do. We possibly did have a golden age of local radio in the UK in the 80s and early 90s, and that's been on the drift probably for 10 or 15 years. And I could easily be accused of being one of the people that's created that drift away from localness. But I think you just go where the audience takes you.
And you go where the money is. You have to do.
You do in a commercial environment, because there's no one there to support you. If you make the wrong decision, you go under. So, yeah.
So what are you doing now then? Do you have a kind of portfolio career with lots of different interests? What's a typical week for you?
Well, a typical week would be lots of work as the co-founder with my friend Matt Deegan and my other friend Michael Cannell. We're three
Matt
founders.
Has on Twitter, he has at Matt.
At Matt, worth a lot of money.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So we are the co-founders of Podcast Live. So that's another venture that is a startup. We all put some money in and try to get this thing going, and it's interesting, and we're doing some live events. We've done three so far this year.
They've been an incredible success. I've been watching them with interest on Twitter.
And that's fun. It's not making us any money as yet, but that's in the nature of startups, isn't it? But that's a new an interesting way of looking at the media for me, and I'm enjoying dealing with the podcasters, putting events together, trying to get the right lineup of players and having fun doing that.
So you're on a podcast right now talking about podcasting and building a podcasting business.
And no doubt being listened to by other podcasters.
Indeed.
Then
there's no listeners, as we agreed earlier.
That's right. Then I also am chairman of a TV commercial production company in Birmingham, which is an interesting business. Then when I'm not doing any of that, I am helping out the Radio Academy as the chair of judges for the ARIAs, which are the UK Radio Industry Awards. And when I'm not doing any of that, I'm trying to encourage people to come and stay in my villa in Mallorca, which we rent out. So that's a business as well. So I've got, and then I'm also the trustee and chairman of the fundraising and marketing committee for a charity called Acorns, which is the UK's largest children's hospice charity based in Birmingham. We've got three hospices, one in the Black Country, one in Birmingham, one in Worcestershire. And that's a very challenging role too, in a challenging charity, in a very difficult sector. So
you clearly, you know, you are clearly a Brummie at heart. Birmingham's very important to you, and radio's very important to you. This seems to be
the two. I'm a Mancunian, by the way.
So why is Birmingham so important to you? Everything seems to go back. All roads lead to, well, not Rome, but Birmingham. It would seem.
Only because I started my career there. I ended up marrying a Brummie. I came back to launch Heart there, mainly, you know, one of the reasons was because the people that employed me, Chris and the other chaps at Chrysalis, said, well, he knows about Birmingham, and we don't know, do we have to go to Birmingham? No, he can go. So,
and what does knowing about Birmingham mean? Just playing Funky Mope by Jasper Carrot?
Oh, don't be so cynical. Birmingham is a great city, and it's fast becoming, I think, the most attractive city in the UK. If you walk from New Street to the Brindley Place business sector, actually, that is transformed.
We've got a couple of clients in Birmingham. I hope they're not listening.
Yeah, and I really think they, you know, Brummies are the salt of the earth, and they are much maligned. And I have to say, one of the reasons they're much maligned is because people take the Mickey out of the Brummie accent, and I think that's a terrible shame. And going back to BR&B, Les Ross, who is the Birmingham, the breakfast presenter on BR&B, who is a Brummie, never made it nationally. And the reason he never made it nationally was because he had a Brummie accent. Mm. On the basis of talent alone, he should definitely have been a national radio star. And I think that's a crying shame for the rest of the UK that they didn't get to hear Les Ross. People in Birmingham did, but no one else.
I've got a couple of friends from Yorkshire who moved to London, like me, to seek fame and fortune, and they took elocution lessons and deliberately and overtly not, they don't sound Yorkshire anymore. I mean, I don't think I sound like some kind of comedy Yorkshireman with a flat cap and a whippet, but I'm certainly not going to hide my accent. That would be weird.
Well, I think it's interesting you say that, and I think you can say that now in 2019. But in 1978, 1979, when I was at university and working on the student radio station there, I absolutely knew in my bones that if I had a broad Mancunian accent, which I did, it was game over for getting a job anywhere but in Manchester. So I worked very hard to lose that accent. And I used to listen back to every show I did, and I could hear the Mancunianisms coming out, and I thought, well, I've got to knock that out of my accent. I've got to try and trim that back. So,
whereas now, of course, it'd be celebrated.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you listen to Radio 4, it's amazing. The whole panoply of accents.
Well, and that's it. The transformation of the Northern accent into something that's completely acceptable on national broadcast platforms, television and radio, is to be applauded. But it then shines a light on the fact that the Brummie accent is still regarded as something that you know to be covered up, and if you think about, if you write down a list of the top 100 radio broadcasters who've been on the BBC, on BBC networks, from Radio 1, Radio 2, Radio 3, 4, 5, there won't be many Brummies in there. Now there'll be a fair few people from the north, but there will not be many Midlanders in that list, and I do think that's a bad thing.
I have a friend and client, Anthony Scaramucci, in America, and he is of the similar view that racism's completely unacceptable in America unless you're an Italian American and they're fair game.
Yeah.
People can mock Italian Americans and people laugh at it, even on late night TV shows. Yeah. But it is just racism. If you did that in any form of like African American or any form of, you know, anyone else, they'd be
okay. Brummies fight back. I can say I've got a lead. Exactly. Brummies fight back. But I married a Brummie. Two of my kids were born in the Midlands. One was born in Yorkshire, by the way. So,
all roads lead to Birmingham for you, even though you've abandoned your Lancashire roots.
Well, what happened was I launched Heart in 94, and then we almost 6 weeks after we launched Heart in the Midlands, we won the London licence. And I said to Jean, my wife, and the guys at Chrysalis, look, I'm going to base myself somewhere between London and Birmingham, and I'll just drive up and down the M40 and try and get them both working. And everybody agreed to that. And we started looking at the London end, and we just gradually kept moving up further up because we thought, crying, we can't afford to live here. And we eventually ended back up in Warwickshire, and we now live in the delights of lovely Royal Leamington Spa, which is, you know, I mean, it's not really Birmingham. I haven't lived in Birmingham for...
It's like me, I tell people I live in Milton Keynes, but I actually live in a hamlet 50 miles out of Milton Keynes, and it's beautiful. For the same money that we've paid in Hampstead, you can have like 2 acres.
I go to Birmingham every month for, you know, business, and
in-laws.
Yeah, the charity that I'm involved in is a Birmingham-based charity, and many of my closest friends live in Birmingham, and as I say, for people that haven't been, it's a great city. So I'll hear nothing bad said about it.
Now, in my car, my wife's got a Tesla, so she's got all the mod cons. But in my car, I still have AM and FM as well as DAB. Yeah. You know, is analog ultimately going to be switched off? Because one of the worst things that happens in my car is when I switch off Spotify, it sometimes defaults back to FM rather than DAB. And obviously, that's the worst thing in the entire world that I have to expose my eardrums to that compression for like 3 seconds.
Oh my goodness! Well, I think FM will be here for a fairly long time to come.
I remember Atlantic 252 Longwave.
Well, I think you only have to look at the fact that there are still significant numbers of people listening to AM. They're either listening to 5 Live or Talk Sport or, you know, any other number of AM stations that are dotted around the dial of gold, etc.
909 and 693 still.
Yeah, and if you think that is 15, 20 years after the introduction of DAB... and 50 years after the introduction of FM, AM still has an audience that makes those people that own AM transmitters very concerned about switching them off.
Concerned in their own interest, of course.
Yeah, so Bauer own Absolute Radio, doing fantastically well.
We've had Dave Berry on, right? a fantastic presenter.
You know, and they've got lots of sub-brands and brands on DAB.
Will he present 6 shows simultaneously?
Brilliant, okay.
Or it might even be 8.
However... they're still on AM. And
unbelievable.
And they haven't switched AM off. And the reason they haven't switched it off is the number of listeners that are being delivered via AM and their economic value far outweigh the cost of keeping the transmitter warm. And until that economic model changes, commercial operators will not want to switch off.
The BBC irked me recently because I preferred the Radio iPlayer app to their BBC Sounds, and of course they just unilaterally switched it off.
Yeah.
And of course, yeah, it was annoying and burdensome for a day, but now I'm on BBC Sounds, I've got used to the interface. Couldn't they do that? Couldn't they say, look, you need to get to FM or DAB?
So the risk that you run as a commercial operator, so if you were Global or Bauer or News UK, the risk you run in agreeing collectively with the BBC, right, we're going to switch it all off, we're all going to go to DAB, is either people will mass migrate from FM or AM to DAB and find new radio stations that aren't yours, and therefore your share will go down, or that people who may only have FM radios in their cars or in the garage at home, they've only got an FM radio, will suddenly find that actually the radio station they listen to is no longer there, so their listening will decline. And that's the risk you run. The risk is
fewer listeners.
Fewer listeners means less money.
Yeah, of course it does.
And what won't happen is that if collectively... So the radio industry delivers 1 billion hours of radio listening a week. That's 50 million people listening for 20 hours, approximately. If that billion hours drops to 900 million or 800 million, the advertising agencies aren't going to say, oh, well, that's fine. We'll give you all a 25% increase on your advertising rate. They're just going to go, well, that's 25% less we need to pay you.
Yeah, sling your rock.
And that is the dilemma for the commercial guys.
We had Chris Byrne sitting in that chair a few weeks ago, and frankly, she's doing a fantastic job running all the BBC's local radio stations. You must have had offers to revitalise BBC local radio yourself, surely. Have you turned them down?
Actually, it's the one area that I really have not been particularly involved in. I don't particularly... think that my skill set would be of more value than some of the other. I mean, there are people in the commercial industry. John Myers, our mutual friend, who died this summer. He did a couple of reports on BBC Local Radio.
He did indeed, the Myers report.
Yeah, and actually, he probably would have been a great guy to go in there and give it a kick up the backside. But you say Chris is doing a great job. It's not something that particularly jumps out at me. I quite like the concept of brands and building brands, and that's not where BBC Local Radio is. So I suspect it would never really be the sort of thing that I'd be too interested in getting involved in.
John Myers is much missed. I know it's easy said when people are dead, you know, they were a legend and, that he was warm-hearted and blah, 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 but he genuinely was. I mean, I love John. I used to sort of have lunch with him every 2 or 3 months, and I had lunch with him about 3 weeks before he died, and we were celebrating the fact that he'd beaten cancer.
Yeah.
No, and then he goes off and plays a round of golf in Scotland and drops dead.
Yeah, it's a remarkable thing. And for people that don't know John, he was the chief exec of GMG Radio. He and I pretty much followed each other's careers. We were both presenters at the same time. We both got into management around the same time. We worked for the same company for a while. We then ended up building our own separate radio empires at the same time. We then, when those things finished, we ended up being, advisors to each other on life and everything else.
So it wasn't like a Bobby and J.R. Ewing. It was more friendly than that.
People who know the inside story will absolutely confirm that for the 5 or 6 years that John was running GMG and I was running Chrysalis in the early 2000s, A, we were friendly rivals, but more than that, we both recognised that the best thing for either of our businesses was to be part of a bigger business with the other one.
A rising tide lifts all boats.
Well, we tried so hard to get those two businesses together, and just corporate shit got in the way on more than one occasion, and that was so frustrating, because actually, had we put those two businesses together, the radio industry would look different today. It definitely would.
So, what's next for you?
I don't know. I'm talking to some people about an interesting new audio project that may or may not come off. I'm interested in...
Do you want to buy a media podcast?
That would be fantastic. I've got the 50 quid in my back pocket.
Then I'd have to pay it back if you take the podcast.
I think I've still got something left to offer in the radio industry, but it's difficult to know quite where that is, because the industry has consolidated so much, and obviously there are very talented people at the top of those companies. But I'd like to think that I could still offer something, which is one of the reasons why I'm enjoying this senior independent advisor role, because I feel I'm offering something back. Podcasting, I think there's something interesting and innovative in podcasting. Whether podcasting can make the economic return that people hope it can make, I don't know. And that's an interesting place to see where that will get to. But I'm finding all of those things interesting.
It's interesting because what interests me about podcasting in terms of monetizing it is one of the reasons why it has such a unique space in the kind of app ecosphere is when Apple created iTunes, they knew how to monetize it. It was $7.99 for an album or 79 pence for a track, but they couldn't work out a way of monetizing podcasts. They never thought someone would pay 79p, because ultimately it is an MP3.
Yeah.
And so they ended up just having it as some kind of offcut app, and it's forced podcasters to try to find ways to monetize it, whether it be advertising, branding, affinity partnerships, or something like this, where I indirectly monetize Media Masters because it raises my profile and it helps me build my Rolodex.
Yeah. I think there is a case for micropayments. And you see some podcasts now that use Patreon as a means to get people to be subscribers. I think there's the free ad-funded, then there's a Patreon, the something in the middle, which is, I want to listen to that podcast and I don't mind paying 10p. And actually, if enough people pay 10p, actually the podcaster is making enough money to keep the thing going. But it's, you know, because those podcasters are going to, in the end, many of them will say, I can't afford to carry on doing this for free, even though there are people out there listening to it. I need to find some way for those people to give me a little bit of money because I can't make any money out of advertising. And I think if you only have 5 or 10,000 subscribers, you're going to struggle to find ad-funded revenue. But actually, if you had 10,000 subscribers who were each giving you 10p a week, you know, that's a grand. And actually, you do that every week, that's 50 grand a year. That's a salary, or it's enough money for you to pay for studio space and do something decent. So I think there are micropayment models that haven't been properly invented or developed yet that might sit alongside the big guys that are getting ad funding and the guys that are well-resourced and niche who maybe have Patreon funding. So I think there's something that sits in the middle, but as I say, it's not there yet.
Why don't you present your own podcast? I mean, to be honest, I'm sure you would find a way to monetize it, be commercially successful, but it would also put you front and centre in terms of exploit. It could be about the commerciality of radio.
Yeah, well, possibly, but I've got so many things on my plate at the moment that I think trying to do something else right now would be a bit of a challenge, possibly next year when there's slightly less on my plate.
Phil, you're a legend. Thank you for your time.
It's a pleasure.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.